This is Jill. I'm talking at volume level 2. Although I don't want to be bent over the whole time.
I know.
Do you think we need it like higher up? Or like set it here? We could scooch over and put it right here.
Is this better if it's like more a voice level? Now I'm also talking louder.
Yes, you are. Is this better?
No.
Do every night, Binky. Take over the world. For Louisa May Alcott.
The lady at Special Collections today.
Oh, tell me.
No. Well, no, I'll save it.
No.
No, I was just kind of like telling her about the podcast and everything, and then she was kind of interested, but then like it was just very obvious that I was just a complete Louisa dork, and she's just standing there because, you know, she won't walk away. She has to watch you, like, look at everything so that you don't steal things or...
Sure, mess them up.
Yep, and so then my phone was laying there, and my phone has that pop socket with Louisa's face, and I saw her kind of, like, glance at it, and I'm like, yeah, I'm a real Louisa nerd. Like, I have her face on everything. No, she was very nice.
I really love having Louisa's face on stuff with no other context. Like, if it doesn't say who it is or what it is. Mm-hmm. I used to have a keychain with her face on it. And one time someone was like, is that your grandmother? And I was like, why would I have a keychain with my grandmother's face on it? It's obviously Louisa May Alcott.
I was at that Milton House Memorial Day, their Civil War days, and the Abraham Lincoln, like, there's a guy who dresses up as Abraham Lincoln, and he looks just like him, and so I was taking a picture of him and Ronan, and afterwards he's like, who is that on your phone? So I explained, and then he was really interested, because obviously it's like the Civil War connection,
right,
and stuff,
right.
But there's been a lot of conversations because of my pop socket.
Good.
Like, who is this dead lady you have on your phone?
Why do you have this Victorian woman on your phone? Why not?
Yeah.
Yeah. Welcome to Let Genius Burn, a podcast about the life and legacy of Louisa May Alcott. I'm Jamie Burgess.
And I'm Jill Fuller.
And today we're talking about our week in Concord, exploring Orchard House, discovering Fruitlands, and walking all the paths where Louisa once walked.
Mm-hmm. That was beautiful. Bravo. We didn't even plan that.
Wasn't that good?
No, it was lovely. So I've been in Concord here with you for almost a week now.
Yeah.
And it's our last night. So we're sitting up late doing this.
And we've had a very full week. We did a lot of things.
Yeah.
I just want to know what it was like for you. You know, because my love for Louisa grew alongside my relationship to her places.
Mm.
I never kind of knew my love for her without those things.
Oh, that's so interesting.
So what was that like for you the first time seeing places and thinking about her walking around and what that must have been like for her?
Yeah, so I really want to journal about this week and I haven't yet because that's kind of just how I process it all. We talked about that the other night.
Yeah.
I would say that it was kind of two sides of a coin kind of a thing where on the one hand, it was really overwhelming because, and just kind of unbelievable. Like, sometimes I would catch myself, you know, like, Louisa stood here, Louisa. Actually, a really interesting time when I thought that wasn't so much when we were, it was a little bit when we were going through Orchard House, but we were talking with Jan and, you know, my son was there. And so I was kind of not quite as able to focus on, like, Louisa was here kind of a thing as much. But what really did it for me was when we were in Sleepy Hollow Cemetery the other morning.
Mm.
We found Louisa's grave first, but then we went, you know, Thoreau's there, and then we went down to see Emerson. And I remembered when she talks about going to Emerson's funeral and coming to Sleepy Hollow for Emerson's funeral.
Right.
And so I was standing, like, near Emerson's grave. And that's when I was like, Louisa was here. And I was remembering that scene specifically in her journal. Or maybe it was a letter. I don't remember where she described it, but she talks about his funeral and stuff. And so that was, like, that was a moment. So, which is kind of interesting. Like, that's not where I would have thought that I would have thought about Louisa, right, but it was right there by Emerson's grave. So it was really overwhelming. It was really wonderful to finally see these places that I've read about so much and to actually understand where they are in location to each other. That was really cool. Like, I feel like I have a better idea of just, yeah, like the town and how far it is from Concord Center to Orchard House and just like these kind of distancey things. When we found the Alcott Thoreau house that Louisa bought later in life and like lived there with, after Orchard House with
where
Anna.
Anna and her
family. It was like, oh my gosh, it's really close to downtown. And this is, you know, like I just had a much better understanding of just where it was. Like mm-hmm. that made like a big difference. So that was really, really cool. Then, but on the flip side, I felt, especially with like Orchard House, I wasn't as emotional inside as I thought I was going to be. And I don't know if like part of it is just because maybe I mean, being there is very different than reading about it, but it also felt like I'd been there before in a very strange way.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if that's because of the movies
right,
or something, right. but that was surprising to me. But just, yeah, I think it made Louisa, I mean, Louisa's really only ever existed for me on the written, on the page,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it's her books or whether it's her, you know, published journals or, you know, whatever it is. But now she was able to exist for me in a three-dimensional space, like mm-hmm. in actual distance and place and time. So I still want to, like, once this week is over, like, do some writing and do some kind of thinking about it, because I think that I kind of want to almost relive it in my head and like reprocess it. But yeah, we saw a lot. Fruitlands was something where I had never really seen any interior pictures. I did not have any concept of where it was located on the land, because you only ever see the picture of the farmhouse.
Sure.
It's like going down that hill and seeing it, and seeing the view. That was very brand new to me. I would say that the Fruitlands experience was like going to Fruitlands was, yeah, like I felt, especially like standing in the kitchen, mm-hmm. I think I talked about it when we were recording, standing in the kitchen, I thought about Abigail a lot, like standing in the kitchen of Fruitlands,
yeah.
just thinking of her working and trying to get food together for the family and trying to figure out what they're going to eat and, you know.
I don't know if I see that house as kind of foreboding, it's like this dark red color. I don't know, there's something about it. If it's just because I know the story of how, you know, this was the place where the family almost unraveled and Bronson
mm-hmm.
really went into such a deep depression.
Mm-hmm.
It was because of this place, this kind of lost dream. This was meant to be the new Eden, and it was sort of the opposite of that. But to me, that farmhouse has always had something a little bit almost sinister as I walk up to it. It's at the bottom of the hill. And, you know, in colonial times, they had such a emphasis on the city on a hill, the place up high,
yeah.
you know. And this is not that way. The house
right.
is down low, and you have to walk up the hill to have the view over valley. And maybe it was a bit different in Louisa's time, there were fewer trees, but certainly it's downhill
mm-hmm.
in any case. And I don't know, something about that for me, it's so different, for example, than the feeling you get when you get to Orchard House.
Yeah that's, I really like that kind of, that turning the simile or the analogy of the city on a hill thing. I'd never thought about that, but you're right. It does kind of give it that very opposite feeling.
Yeah.
I love what they've done there at Fruitlands,
yes,
how they interpret it, and then also just the other, you know, what Clara Sears has done, all those other buildings. We didn't get to go into any of the other ones really, but just even hearing, you know, Catherine talk about kind of the vision that Clara Sears had and just, you know, how that collection came to be. I think it's really neat that they have taken something that is like this really dark period of Louisa's history, and then, you know, they've the concerts out on the lawn, like, you know, I thought about when we were watching the concert and the sun was setting, I thought about Louisa again, you know, kind of walking those hills and whatever, yeah. And just the Concord band played a movement from like the Little Women, I don't know, musical or what musical, that was from. Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, they said it was like the Little Women something.
It didn't sound like one of the movie soundtracks.
No, it wasn't. I wasn't familiar with it, but yeah. They said it was Little Women. And so I just, that kind of, I was like, you know, Louisa was here, and then here's like music inspired by her art.
Yes.
You know, so art begetting art kind of a thing, which I think is always so fascinating. Here, on this hillside, this beautiful space that was not always very beautiful for her. I just thought that's kind of that beautiful, like, full circle moment kind of thing. I loved that.
Right, and you always wonder in those moments, like, how much Louisa would like and appreciate that, or whether she would say, oh, this is kind of an eye roll, like, why do people still read Little Women?
I think she'd maybe appreciate, I like to hope that she would appreciate, like, good art coming from good art. I think maybe as long as she wasn't expected to stand up on the stage and give a speech, she'd be fine with it, maybe.
Well, and I think she did understand what people loved about Little Women.
Yeah.
Even though she probably felt, well, it doesn't represent the truth. Mm-hmm. In a literal sense, it represented some greater truth, the mm-hmm. way that everything is always more than the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much about the actual, whether or not she had put in all the details, but she put in enough of the family and their story to mm-hmm. to understand that other readers really knew it as true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The heart of it was true.
Yeah. Something that struck me, so when we went to the special collections today at the Concord Library, got to look at two manuscripts, handwritten manuscripts, two chapters from Little Women,
wow.
which was amazing. And then got to see the illustrations. Who was...
Frank Merrill.
Frank Merrill, that's right. So got to see his pen and ink drawings, like his, you know, that then Louisa commented on.
Yes.
And then, like, they got changed or whatever for the final printing. But one of the things that struck me was kind of coming back to some of her own personal issues with Little Women and the fame that it brought her. But here it was, I asked the special collections librarian because I couldn't remember, like, when were these done? Like, when was this edition? She said about, like, 1880 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's what she said. And so here it is, like, you know, over 10 years later, over a decade later, and, you know, this is something that this book was not, you know, something she wanted to write or anything, but she's commenting on these drawings, and some of them are, you know, she's got very specific ideas about what the characters are supposed to look like.
Yes.
And she's like, Teddy's face is too round, or Joe's hair is not long enough, and Joe looks too old, or Professor Bear, you know, or sometimes she had very positive comments. She was like, you know, this is lovely, or Professor Bear looks very droll, like, this is great, you know. And that did make me think that, you know, and part of it may be just because of, like, she wanted to make sure she's a perfectionist or something, like, who knows, but she did care about the book, about the quality of it, about the characters. Like, she had ideas in her head of what these characters should look like.
Yeah.
You know, so there's so much made of the fact that, like, oh, you know, she wasn't a fan of Little Women and all this stuff. But obviously, you know, it's a decade later, and she cares about, like, she still has these pictures in her head of what these characters are supposed to look like and who they're supposed to be and how they're supposed to be represented. And that just kind of really struck me about, like, oh, she does care about this book, and she does care about these characters. So that kind of was a little bit of a different angle to see those comments and to see her, like, you know, going through and really checking and making sure that this is right and that this scene is represented the right way. Like, you know, I think you have to care about something in order to take the time to do that, you know. And so that just really struck me. I knew she had made comments on them before, but to actually see those comments, to see her go one by one through them and really, you know, take the time to, you know, one of them, she's like, this needs to have some more mountains in the background to give it the full effect. It was like, I don't remember, it's like Amy and Lori or something, you know. So she's like really looking at them and thinking of it in her head, even 11, 12 years after having written it, you know. Yeah. So
so fun to see her handwriting and think about her mm-hmm. leaned over a page like that.
Yeah.
Writing furiously with the numb fingers.
Yeah. And it was sometimes it was hard to read, like, Nate, and I'm like, Nate, what is this? Like, what is this word? Like, what do you think it says? For the most part, I was able to figure it out. But it was very cool to see. And in the manuscript that we looked at, it said on the back that she had saved them by her mother's request, or mother's desire.
Okay.
So I kind of love that the reason that those are saved is because Abigail wanted to keep them. I thought that was lovely.
That is.
That's very Abigail. I mean, that's very Abba, you know?
Well, she had quite a realistic sense of who her daughters were and what they were capable of. And it's very beautiful that her realistic vision of Louisa was, well, realistically, you will be a famous author and you will have all this attention and people will be still interested in this in 150, 200 years mm-hmm. from now.
Yeah, she had full confidence in that girl, didn't she? Yeah.
But like I'm saying, it wasn't fanciful. It wasn't mm-hmm. invented. It was just her, you know, being pragmatic, which she was.
Yeah.
And she was pragmatic. Like Louisa was as well.
Yeah. So one of the things we got to do this week was give a presentation, speaking of Fruitlands. Mm-hmm. How did you feel about that?
I mean, it felt like a dream come true. Standing there looking at the farmhouse and getting to comment on what I think Fruitlands meant to Louisa over the course of her life. I don't pretend to know those kinds of things, but it is interesting to look for the clues that it had to have affected her deeply. So as I'm standing there and thinking about Louisa just as a child on the grounds of Fruitlands, that was the age that I also had to grow up very quickly. It was 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And so when we talked with Leslie Scomp earlier in season two about that experience of that age and what it means to a girl, I was thinking about that a lot when we were standing there, like, oh, shoot, that's so young.
Mm-hmm.
It's so young to have to pretend to care about why you can't drink milk or why mm-hmm. you can't use a wool blanket or,
mm-hmm.
you know, put on something warmer or...
Mm-hmm. And to really see your parents as fallible human beings that are failing at something, and to, you know, I feel like up until that point as a child, you just assume your parents know everything and are just able to do anything.
Have it under control.
And then to really see that unravel and to recognize that, oh, my, these parents, like, I'm not safe, or I'm not, you know, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what thoughts went through her head, but really, you know, it's kind of when that shifts, I think, for a child, because it does for everybody when you finally start to see your parents as imperfect and, you know, or not able to do everything you thought they could do. And this was really that, I feel like, probably that main moment for Louisa where it's like, oh, my father and my mother are not okay right now. And there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's difficult for every child. And then, you know, tenfold when it's a circumstance like that, I think.
It's almost worse that it took place against such a beautiful backdrop. I don't know why, but when I think of the natural beauty of Fruitlands, it's so funny too, because yes, you're getting into central Massachusetts at that point, but you're still basically in Eastern Massachusetts, I mean, heavily populated, densely populated area. And even today, when you look out, you don't see that many buildings. I mean, mm-hmm. the trees really create this effect that you are far from civilization, that mm-hmm. you are really in nature, and the short distances that we can cover today, you know, the 14 miles between Harvard and Concord, in Louisa's time, they must have seemed like such a great distance.
Mm-hmm.
And you almost wish that this really difficult thing had just been in a place that wasn't just so baldly standing there in all of its beauty while you suffer.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of an indifferent nature.
Yeah, that's true. That's a really good point. And the isolation, I guess I hadn't thought about that either, but you're right. Also, that distance thing, like being able to see how far it is from Concord and then thinking about how long it would have taken people to come and visit, or for people, you know, that sense of isolation yeah. must have been a little terrifying too, not just for the girls, but maybe for Abigail even.
Yeah.
You know, just like, I'm very cut off from people I know. I'm not close to neighbors. I'm not able to really ask for help from other people because I'm just, that sense of isolation, not just the distance, but yes, the landscape itself oh, yeah. lends itself to that feeling of isolation.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And imagine it all covered in white in wintertime. It must have just seemed so far away.
Yeah.
I loved being at Fruitlands. I especially loved learning about the Greta Gerwig film, how it was made, what pieces of it were shot there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was great.
I loved that, just the crowd, the people that we had that were listening yes. to the talk, they were wonderful. They yes. asked such good questions. Susan came and Azalina came.
Yes.
Shout out to both of them, you know, two Alcott scholars that and friends that we love. So it was wonderful to see them there and to talk with people who are really interested and really just want to know more. You know, it's something that we do here with the podcast. I mean, we interact with people all the time on Instagram and stuff like that. But like, to then do it face-to-face. And we've done a couple of, you know, Zoom presentations, but really to be face-to-face with people.
In the landscape.
Oh my gosh. Incredible. Just absolutely yeah. incredible. Yeah, dream come true is the best way to put it. That was
really cool.
Such a great opportunity. Speaking of Orchard House, we got to meet up with Jan there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to meet Jan in person for the first time, and that was great as well. And she was kind enough to kind of lead us through Orchard House and it was really great. That's something that I want to reflect on a lot because it felt so quick, even though it wasn't. We actually had quite a long tour,
right?
But it felt quick, and there's so much to take in.
There's so much to see there. Yeah, that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I really feel the Alcott still at Orchard House. Like mm-hmm. I know that that's not where they lived at the end of their lives, but for the most part. But I really feel them there. I love May's paintings everywhere. Mm-hmm. I love to see her artwork. I always feel so sort of sure of her, I don't want to say greatness, but that she had, mm-hmm. that she really had a quality about her work that was unique and it was really moving in such a positive way before mm-hmm. she died. And it's great that Orchard House is a place where you can go and see so much of it together.
Mm-hmm. I think that's actually the one time I did get really emotional at Orchard House was in May's room on the dresser. There's a picture of Ernst Nieriker, her husband, and then a picture of Lulu. It's kind of a famous picture that's, mm-hmm. you know, circulated other places. Lulu's maybe about two or three.
Holding the doll.
And to see that picture in May's room, I did get a little teary
yeah.
because it's just like, you know, May never got to see Lulu at that age and, you know, never really got to see Lulu much at all.
Right.
And so to kind of think of May, like you said, the drawings on the wall, you know, the ones like under the window, to think of May, I thought of May like sitting there. You should be sitting on the floor doing mm-hmm. those, you know, because it's underneath the window. And to think of her sitting right there, and then here's a picture of her daughter that she never really got to see, like kind of that time overlapping mm-hmm. kind of thing. And that, you know, that was a little emotional.
Yeah. Well, and you got to swim in Walden Pond.
Yep.
The famous Walden Pond.
Sure did. Which I didn't realize was not forested like that in Louisa's time.
No.
I hadn't really thought about that.
Much fewer trees.
Yeah. My son loved it. That was his favorite part, I think. That and the ocean today.
Well, you can see why it was special for Thoreau as well, even back then.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a beautiful spot.
Mm-hmm.
Annie Dillard wrote her dissertation, or her master's thesis, I think it's her master's thesis, on how Walden Pond acts as like the intermediary between God and Earth for Thoreau in his writings. And sometimes I think about that when I see the pond is so kind of still and you can see the reflections of everything on the water.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful writing that she did about the pond.
Mm.
It is very special. I don't know if I think it's a vortex that will, you know, connect you to a ley line or something if you go swimming in it.
Maybe not.
Very beautiful. Very nice. Peaceful. Yeah.
Well, and speaking of Thoreau, before I came, you got to present at the Thoreau Conference. And you talked about Pauline's Passion and Punishment, right? One of Louisa's stories.
I did. I talked about her choice of Cuba as the setting because the theme of the panel was where in the world is Louisa May Alcott? So it was kind of an international theme. And that was true for the whole conference because the conference theme was global Thoreau.
Mm.
So there were many international scholars there. That part of it was great. But the reason I chose this topic is because Louisa really doesn't write that much about setting. Like, think of a time in Little Women where she writes a paragraph describing the setting.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, right. There isn't
any. No, she's very dialogue-driven and character-driven.
It's almost like a play. I mean, that's why it's been adapted so easily to the screen and to the stage. And she focuses heavily on plot, moving the plot forward, and, of course, on character and dialogue. But there's very little description of setting. And I felt when I read Pauline's Passion and Punishment, and I still feel this way, that she was different about the setting, that the quality of her writing is a bit different when she describes the place. The bulk and action of the short story does not take place on Cuba, but it takes place sort of in the shadow of Cuba, or like in its absence, in this like negative space, which is to say it takes place in not Cuba. And the writing is so enthusiastic about the Cuban coffee plantation. I want to know where that came from. So it's about Gothic interpretations of nature and how Louisa used the Gothic. She absolutely did this as a literary device because, as we know, she was very connected to Transcendentalism. I mean, at heart, I think that was a big part of her spirituality. She believed she found nature to be divine. She found God when she was in nature. And yet, in her Gothic thrillers, she's really able to use nature for the opposite effect. So, my talk was kind of about that. It was great to connect with the other Alcott scholars at the conference and the Thoreau people. Those Thoreau people really know how to party. You wouldn't think about that from Thoreau's countenance. He comes off as quite serious and deliberate and intentional in all his writings. And he was that way, but these people love to... There are all these Thoreau types. Hikers, naturalists, botanists. And I get the feeling that a lot of them are like Thoreau in the sense that they're quite solitary, but they seek the company of a select group who can give them a new intellectual perspective. And I would say that's exactly what you do at this conference for 4 days. 5 days, even.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was great.
I'm sad that I missed it. Although we did get to go to the Throw House.
Mm-hmm.
And they had like a little picnic thing to end the conference. And right. So we got to go to that and have some cake and have a picnic.
Yeah, so that was Henry's birthday cake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because we were at Walden on Thoreau's birthday, July mm-hmm. 12th, mm-hmm. which was kind of unintentional on our part, but that's how the cookie crumbled. That's how it shook out. And then that night you and I went out to dinner to celebrate, because mm-hmm. July 12th was also the 1 year anniversary of the launch of Let Genius Burn. So
that's it's been a year.
Quite a year.
It really has. Even a year ago, I wouldn't have thought we would get the opportunities that we've had to
mm-hmm.
Spend this time with these Alcott people and to give the presentation at Fruitlands and to be so embraced, I would say, also by the Louisa May Alcott community.
Absolutely.
The society being so supportive.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great community. You know, talking about the Thoreau type, but the Alcott people are wonderful. Like, you know, it's just been fun to make connections with people who I've read their pieces and, you know, but now to actually connect with them. And,
yeah.
You know, so it's just, yeah, it's just been very exciting and gratifying. So we celebrated with really good food and really good desserts. The pot au creme and peach crisp were amazing.
The dessert was the best part.
Yeah.
So glad we got you.
It was very good.
The Alcott people, I think, are more extroverted generally than the Thoreau people. I'm totally generalizing, and it's not exactly true. But when we had the Alcott people over for a barbecue...
Oh, that's right. We haven't talked about the cookout.
I felt like it was just silly and mm-hmm. fun and games.
Which is very Louisa-ish.
And these are very serious people, frankly, in their lives. I mean, some of them have, you know, quite scientific careers, degrees from Ivy League universities, very serious people. And yet when they, like you said, they're very Louisa-esque, theatrical, and mm-hmm. telling the way they tell stories.
Yeah.
That's a lot like her.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I love that you put that together. That was a really sweet thing to do, because it was just a great opportunity to meet people that I hadn't met or had only met online, like Lauren, and then Jan came again, so we got to see her a second time, and that was incredible. I understood what you meant. You've talked a lot about being at Orchard House as a guide, that community of people who are there, and just like how close-knit you become, and like you feel like you're part of this group of people who really care about this, like a family, and I feel like I got a piece mm-hmm. of that, or a little understanding of it, just in those few hours, just sitting around talking about our favorite person. And like, I mean, it made me think about, and I've told this story before, but when I contacted you about a podcast idea, it was because I was on my way home from that Greta Gerwig movie and being like, I just want to talk to people about Louisa. And that I thought about that when I was sitting at the table, I was talking to Jesse, and Jesse was telling me a story. And I'm, like, hearing Jan and Lauren and a couple others and Kathy talk about Louisa and about the pickled limes and whatever they're talking about in the background. And I was like, I totally got my wish. I am sitting here surrounded by people who love and admire Louisa and the Alcotts, and I am just sitting here talking to people about Louisa. And I was like, it just filled me up. I was like, I got what I wanted. Like,
yeah, here I am. You put it out there and it came back to you. That's so great.
Yeah, well, so much of that is because of you. I couldn't have done it alone. You took a chance on me.
I think it's the other way around, frankly. But I think it's a great joy for me to, you know, share this thing with someone. Because I do talk about it all the time. I've had a framed picture of Louisa in every room I've ever lived in. And, you know, when I've lived in other countries, or when I lived in Colorado, which often felt like another country, when I would come back to New England from Colorado, I would always say, like, when I go back to America. people didn't know who Louisa was, you know, in those contexts, and I would try to explain why it's so important to me. And that was really difficult to explain.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, that you can see what it was like to have this group of women around me when I was fresh out of college, and how that helped me to grow, how Louisa's example, and frankly, many of the Alcotts, their examples, Abigail and May in particular, and even Bronson in certain ways, you know, how that shaped who I became. It's so important to me.
Yeah, I can understand that a little better now, having sat around a picnic table with a group of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we used to do all kinds of museum outings, and we had a book club. We had, like, quite an active book club where we read, not necessarily, they were all Alcott tangents, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have great, great discussions about that. So.
Yeah.
So during the Thoreau Conference, Azalina Flint, who is an Alcott scholar from England, gave a presentation about Louisa and iconography. The question, where in the world is Louisa May Alcott? She was saying, Louisa is, for me, kind of in this liminal space between Earth and, you know, whatever you believe in comes next. And that Louisa sits on my shoulder as I read and so on. It was really beautiful what she said. And I'm paraphrasing and not doing it justice, but it was something along those lines. And then she cited a very specific artist who had a way of drawing icons, and it was meant as an exercise to, you know, create visibility for women. And there was a queer aspect to it as well, which I'm not remembering exactly, but it was... That was part of the title of Azalina's presentation. And so she had us actually draw these icons. And she played music, which turned out that she had chosen this very specific music, this hymn that was Marmy's favorite hymn, and had us follow the directions to draw these icons. So, you know, you're drawing and you're supposed to be thinking about the person that you're drawing while you're making it. And she had some quotes, and she told up on the projector, and she told us, like, we could choose a word from the quotes. And they were quotes from Louisa's journals, and they were full of, you know, very descriptive and important words. And it really gave me a chance to reflect on Louisa and what I think about her, why I admire her. And I was thinking of what John Madison said at the end of our interview, at the end of season two, when he said, you know, the pendulum has gone as far as it can go in the direction of selfishness and materialism. And when it inevitably swings back, it will be Louisa's example that guides us with kindness. And I really thought about that quote as I was drawing. Of course, John was sitting, like, directly across from me, so maybe that was part of it. But it was a really meaningful exercise. I loved it, and I loved that she took a risk with these other academics and scholars who were attending the conference to encourage them to use a medium besides writing to express how they feel about this person.
Mm-hmm.
There was someone at the Thoreau Conference who asked each of the panels about, like, what our historical figure meant to us. So he asked the Margaret Fuller people, well, what does Margaret Fuller mean to you?
Mm-hmm.
What does Ralph Waldo Emerson mean to you? And when I was thinking about, oh, he's going to ask me that, I better be ready.
Mm-hmm.
He actually didn't get to that point, because another person asked about Jo March. She said, you know, little girls read about Jo March and they really love what she represents. You know, how do you kind of bridge that gap between Jo and Louisa? And I said, I think it's great that, you know, little girls relate to Joe. That's how they discover their individuality. They discover that they don't have to conform. They don't have to follow these very strict feminine rules and guidelines to become a woman. When Louisa was that, you know, tenfold, she was more brazen than Joe. She was funny and she went to war. She was an activist. Those are things that Joe didn't dare to do in Little Women. So if you admire Joe's life, like, I have news for you. There is more than that out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So those were some of the thoughts that came up for me at the Thoreau conference. And I will just say that it's really, really worthwhile to sit in a room with people who care about those things that you care about for a couple days out of the whole year.
I really hope that the Summer Conversational Series, which is kind of that lecture series that Orchard House does every summer, I really hope that's in person next year, because if it is, I'm gonna figure out a way to get back here, because just that just feeling of community and I want that some more.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. Was that, so that was along the lines of what you would have said if he had asked you?
I think I got the chance to express it in that, answering that question about Joe. But I also felt I got the chance to explore that when I was drawing the icon and thinking about what words I would use to describe Louisa's heart's desire or Louisa's words. One of them had to do with, you know, speaking the truth, and you drew like a little speech bubble coming out from her mouth, so she had to say something that was very true. And it's hard to pick, honestly.
Yeah, right. You'll have to send me that link. There's a recording, right?
Yeah. Okay. I got it today.
Oh, good. Okay. If you can forward it to me, because I really want to watch. I want to watch yours as well, but I'd love to see Azalina's.
Yeah.
Maybe do the icon for myself.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I'd love to do that. Yeah. Kind of that reflection.
I wrote green in the middle of my heart for Louisa's heart's desire, because all she ever wanted was money. And she got it.
Yeah. Well, and it goes with the nature thing, too.
It does, but all she really wanted was to take care of Marmee, I think. Marmee. Abigail.
Yeah. Well, that was her Marmee. Mommy, as she would have said.
Mommy.
Mommy. Which I love.
Katharine Hepburn does it quite well, I think, in that version of Little Women.
I've never seen that version.
Oh, you should.
I should.
Okay, so sometime we're going to, like, just watch all the Little Women's in a row, because I've done it, and it's great.
That sounds amazing. That's what you should. You should come to my house, and we should do that. Oh, I told Nate I want to rewatch this summer some, like, the three most recent ones, like the three that, you know, that I'm familiar with. I was like, I just want to watch all three, because usually it's like I watch one and maybe a couple of months later I watch another one. I'm like, I want to watch all three, like in a week or something, in a couple of weeks. Especially now that, having been here, and I've got a lot of good reading up ahead. I wanted to read The Transcendentalists and Their World, They're Robert Gross. And now I've got a couple other books I picked up this week. I saved The Transcendentalists in Their World because I was thinking, I want to read it after I'm here, because then I can better picture everything. Yeah, and I'm really glad that I did, because there were things that I just did not expect them to, you know, the old manse is like sitting in the middle of a field. You know, I did not really expect it to be where it was. I mean, there's a road next to it, you know, but that's in a very different spot. In different location and different atmosphere than I would have thought. So things like that, I'm glad that I'll be able to read now and get some of that.
Right. You'll have the landscape in mind. Well, I'm really glad you came.
I'm really glad I came too. Thanks for having us.
I had the best time.
Oh, we had so much fun. It's going to be hard to leave tomorrow.
Yeah. Don't go.
Oh, I'm gonna miss you.
Yeah. We could be a consociate family.
We could. Oh, I'm sure I could find a job out here somewhere, right?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely.
Okay. Good night, friend.
Good night.
Talk to you again.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this trip to Louisa May Alcott's world in Concord, Massachusetts through these bonus episodes. For more about Louisa, follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Let Genius Burn. If you're enjoying the show, please give us 5 stars on your podcast app. Reviews help us find new listeners and new fans for Louisa. Find more information in the show notes and on our website at letgeniusburn.com.